The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow wherever you are. Tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
So some of our users, for example, say, well, I'm not a target. Nobody's going to care about what I'm doing because I'm just the librarian, or I don't work on anything that would be interesting to these foreign governments. But the task is that all they care about is how they get in. And once they get in, even if it's through, you know, an admin assistant to or an accountant's desktop, then they look to move laterally throughout the network. So it's not enough to just secure certain accounts or certain servers. We have to lock down and protect everything as much as we possibly can. And then there's the task of end user communication and education. By far the easiest way for an outside actor to get in is through a phishing email. Somebody is in a hurry and clicks on something without thinking about whether it completely makes sense or without inspecting the information about the email to see if it's legitimate. And then software can be downloaded onto their computer from a website or something without them being any the wiser.
I'm Cody Poplin, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, October 10th, 2015. That was Helen Moorman, the Chief Information Officer at the Brookings Institution, discussing the difficulties of securing a large, public-facing organization from a vast array of cyber attacks. As listeners may know, while we often talk about cybersecurity on the show, Brookings itself has been subject to a number of cyber attacks in recent years, from infiltrations led by Chinese government-affiliated units to more run-of-the-mill hacker intrusions. This week on the Lawfare podcast, Helen walks Ben through the threat environment that an organization like Brookings faces, and she outlines some of the steps organizations and individuals can take to shore up their own security. It's the Lawfare podcast, episode number 142, Helen Moorman on cybersecurity in an insecure environment.
So let's start with just kind of a broad overview of how all of these broad international cybersecurity challenges that everybody seems to be talking about, what they look like from the point of view of somebody who is responsible for the cybersecurity of an institution like Brookings?
Well, it's a continual challenge, one that demands pretty much constant vigilance. The threat landscape changes almost daily. I'm probably not aware of changes quite as quickly as they're actually happening, but the reports that you see not only in the mainstream press, but also trade press, vendor announcements, etc. You know, if you sign up for all the possible RSS feeds, you'd be getting something, several things probably every day of one kind or another. So just keeping up with the evolving nature of the attacks is one challenge. The other challenges are clearly having enough tools and qualified staff to properly operate them, keeping senior management and other major stakeholders in an institution briefed on, you know, what the threats are, what we're finding, how we think we stand at any given time, connecting with various law enforcement agencies, which can be very helpful, connecting with all of our peers to share information, which is also very helpful. So if I let it would be a full-time job, just for me. And clearly I have many other things I need to be thinking about.
So what is what percentage of your time does it occupy?
I would guess most of the time, probably 20 to 25%, and sometimes much more.
All right, so let's talk about one of those times. It is a matter of public record that Brookings was at one point the subject of a significant Chinese cyber operation. How did that present to you, and what were you in a position to do about it, and what did it involve addressing it?
Well, we were alerted to the intrusion by one of our newer software tools, and it's a newer tool to the market. One interesting thing about the newest kind of cybersecurity attacks is all the different vendors who have started up, many of which just in the last 2 to 5 years, to address these attacks with more sophisticated tools. And one of these providers alerted us to suspicious behavior that they had also seen in another think tank at pretty much the same time.
When was this?
This was in June of 2014. We immediately called in some outside forensic consultants to help us understand exactly what was happening, and some of the more senior advanced engineers within the software company that had detected this also got involved with us to help us understand the implications and do the forensic analysis about how were we infected, where were we infected, what were they after, had they been able to actually exfiltrate what they were looking for, et cetera. And in an initial event like that, it's quite like the fog of war in that you have very incomplete information. You know, you're clearly trying to keep the senior management of the institution briefed, and you're rarely able to answer all the questions that they immediately have. And you also have to decide, for example, how much time and money you want to spend trying to figure out exactly how this happened, knowing that you may never really know, no matter how many resources you throw at it. And so I think most institutions, at least initially, focus more on remediation. The expertise we usually get is don't take any actions to give yourself away to the intruder that you know that they're there until you're willing to, until you've planned your complete remediation and you are willing to not only kick them out, but have put up enough new defenses that they can't immediately get back in. When intruders do get into your network, they tend to plant almost sleeper cells type of malware, so that if they see you going after an active set of malware, they can let you take that one down because they know they can then activate something else. So you end up doing an extremely thorough review across your network, across all your devices, all the different logs that you've been tracking, et cetera. So I would say, given the nature of what we learned starting back in June, the effort to put new defenses in place and completely clean up or be prepared to clean up our network over a series of 2 weekend outages that we deliberately caused later that summer, it pretty much consumed, I'd say, 90% of the IT department for a good 2.5 to 3 months. And it also then made us defer things that we would have preferred to be working on in order to focus so intensively on that activity. And so at the end of the process, when we had put a lot of new tools in place, built some new systems that we had not yet brought online, we actually took Brookings completely off the internet for about 12 to 13 hours while we were putting all this in place. Disabled all of our users' accounts and gave them all new passwords, and then had a very well-orchestrated process for the following business day to, you know, re-enable all of Brookings staff and affiliates to be able to do their jobs. It was quite the undertaking.
So, and this was not the first time there had been a significant intrusion, right?
True. In the summer of 2011, we had an alert from a more a different software provider about some suspicious activity, and then within just a day or two of us noticing that, were contacted by a branch of the FBI who had seen some Brookings IP addresses referenced in, you know, what they were tracking. And they wanted us to know what they had been able to find out through their sources. In that case, and that was actually not too long after Google had gone public about what had happened with them, with their intellectual property. And we immediately reached out to them and others to get advice and started down what has now become a very time-consuming path for us in all this constant monitoring and tracking and vigilance that we have. But in the summer of 2011, the intrusion was not as pervasive, it was not quite as much work to clean it up, nor did we go to such great lengths with our end users. We had everybody change their password, but we let them do it themselves. We didn't disable all of the accounts and force a reset.
So from an outside perspective, and perhaps from an inside perspective too, it's a little opaque why a foreign intelligence service would be interested in the Brookings Institution. We don't deal in secret or classified material. We publish stuff. I mean, if you want to know what the Brookings Institution is up to, there's no better intelligence source on that than the Brookings website, which, you know, gives a pretty good idea of everything or most everything that's going on here. Our scholars generally work on the basis of the public domain's material. So from your perspective of trying to defend the institution, what is it about it that makes it an attractive multiple attack target of, you know, whether it's, you know, of presumably more than one foreign entity?
Well, I don't truly know, but what I think, and I think what my colleagues at the FBI have indicated, and all of the think tanks, or many of the think tanks in the Washington, D.C. area have also been targets. This is not at all unique to Brookings, is that a lot of the people who work here have advisory and confidential relationships with senior people in U.S. and foreign administrations. They have sources of information that are perhaps dissidents within a variety of countries that they're in touch with as they're forming their own public policy views, which may later become public. But on the way to something becoming public, I'm told that foreign governments perceive a lot of value out of seeing something before it's published, particularly if it's something that might influence a U.S. or foreign government's own policy. We have people here that have been in very sensitive positions in the U.S. government or foreign governments before, and people, other governments, the state-sponsored bad actors, may in fact think, and I don't know if it's true, that they would, you know, get access to other people through potentially using Brookings as a distribution point for malware, which I'm glad to say has not happened, at least not yet, or, you know, get inside other organizations somehow because of the correspondence or document sharing that we sometimes do with other agencies.
So is your impression that the entity that you have to worry about is China? Or is your impression that it is a more diverse group of foreign actors that, you know, we could reasonably be expecting to target us?
I think it's a diverse group of foreign actors that we have to be prepared for. I think China is by far the most aggressive on many fronts. But there are other governments that we've been alerted to by the FBI that have been targeting Brookings or other think tanks as well.
All right, so let's talk about the task of securing an entity like Brookings, which strikes me as somebody who works here, something of a nightmare. So you have 150 scholars, each of whose job is to be as outward-facing as possible, doing a lot of media, corresponding with everybody who might want their policy advice. You have a building that is pretty open to the public in terms of people coming to events. You have, let's say, not the world's most cyber alert workforce, both in terms of age demographic and in terms of people's basic training. And then you have the usual tension that exists between an IP department of a non-IP institution and the sort of content folks who want to do whatever they want to do and want it to be as convenient as possible. So how do you, like, I understand, oh, and by the way, it's totally non-hierarchical, so nobody really has a boss, right?
Right.
So I understand in a defense contractor, right, you say, okay, from now on, everybody's going to behave this way. You have, I can even understand in a tech company where people are kind of highly tech literate and really understand the stakes about stuff. But I think Brookings, like a university, is really not like that and is unusually, therefore, vulnerable. And I'm interested, just what do you... How do you deal with a challenge like that? What's the strategy for reducing its vulnerability, particularly against state actors who can be very focused and very disciplined?
Excellent question. We certainly have a lot of perimeter defenses, as everybody does, and we have put policies in place and mechanics in place to prevent some of our end users from doing the most, taking actions that would be the most, make us the most vulnerable. So, for example, as you well know, scholars and their support staffs, et cetera, do not have system administrator rights on their workstations and laptops. If you want software installed, you have to come through the IT department. And that's because the golden ticket that bad actors are looking for are passwords or credentials of people who have what they call escalated privileges. A systems administrator can go in potentially to any system or many systems at the lowest level, get information, copy information, destroy information, what have you. So that's what they're always after. So by not giving our end users system administrator credentials and then having very strong policies in place within the IT department about how we manage system administrator credentials, that helps cut down or make it much more difficult for the bad actors to get in. That said, we always assume, and I think all modern IT departments now assume, that we will be compromised. And in the state of compromise, someone has been able to get in, but perhaps has not yet created a complete breach where they've been able to get what they want and get it out. So, for example, in the old days, maybe just 5 or 6 years ago, you would have assumed that traffic inside much of the network was trusted. That if you were if something looked like it was an email coming from you to someone else within Brookings, or you were accessing one of our central services, with the username BWITUS, that really was you, and we wouldn't think anything more about it. Now we don't operate that way. We have firewalls and segmentations within our network to basically ensure that only certain types of users and only certain types of traffic can go through certain types of ports or get to certain services. So we do not assume anymore that anything that's going on sort of behind various firewalls is safe and secure. And many of the tools that we've put in place are equally suspicious and are constantly looking for behavior, electronic behavior that perhaps doesn't make sense. Why is this type of server trying to talk to this type of server where there's no really logical reason why it would? Because once malware is established within the network, or once an outside actor has perhaps live access to your network through Trojan software, et cetera, they will look to laterally move within the network to get what they want. So some of our users, for example, say, well, I'm not a target. Nobody's going to care about what I'm doing because I'm just the librarian, or I don't work on anything that would be interesting to these foreign governments. But the task is that all they care about is how they get in. And once they get in, even if it's through, you know, an admin assistant to or an accountant's desktop, then they look to move laterally throughout the network. So it's not enough to just secure certain accounts or certain servers. We have to lock down and protect everything as much as we possibly can. And then there's the task of end-user communication and education. By far the easiest way for an outside actor to get in is through a phishing email. Somebody is in a hurry and clicks on something without thinking about whether it completely makes sense or without inspecting the information about the email to see if it's legitimate. And then software can be downloaded onto their computer from a website or something without them being any the wiser. And so end-user education is very important to try to make people think twice about opening attachments that they weren't expecting or, you know, clicking on links.
And have you found that as the end-user education about those emails has gotten better, the focus of the foreign, the focus of the attackers has moved to other things, or has that stream of spear phishing material kept up?
It's not only kept up. They have gotten increasingly sophisticated about what's referred to as social engineering, which is crafting an email that will look so authentic or legitimate to you or be so interesting because of something they know about you that you will click on it.
So I one of these emails got forwarded to me, as you know. I have to say, very impressed with it, you know, just as a the target of it sent it along to the people who it mentioned, including me, and it was followed almost immediately by a note from you saying, "Do not open that message." So, I don't want to describe it because I don't want to, you know, say things I shouldn't say. But I'm curious, at what level of generality or granularity you can describe what these sort of emails are doing, and how what this idea of social engineering of an email means in practice.
Well, you have to remember first that the people employed in other countries to do this are professionals, and they're paid. This is not some computer science student somewhere just seeing what they might be able to get away with. These are large cadres of people whose job it is every day to go to work and try to break into whatever institution they've been assigned to break into. So they will go to our public sources of information about our scholars and our senior administrators. They can look them up on LinkedIn and Facebook. They can find out what they've published recently, what organizations they belong to, and then they go about perhaps spoofing email addresses of people who are known to be colleagues of theirs, and, you know, creating content that can be even very time sensitive. It might be an email referring to something that was just published yesterday by somebody else in the field, for example, because they're tracking the relationships that we have with others outside of Brookings, you know, that closely when they're really targeted to get in. I'll give you one example that I can sanitize somewhat, but it shows what can happen and how much we have to, how collaborative we try to be with others who are fighting these same challenges. We got a call from the office of a prominent official in the U.S. administration who at one time was a Brookings scholar. And their office had received an email from a reporter who forwarded an email that looked as if it had come from this person's Brookings username and account, which had been disabled for years, but the bad guy's a spoof to this account. So it looked like it was coming from this person's previous Brookings account. But the reporter knew enough to know that that seemed suspicious, so he called the official's office, forwarded them the email, then they contacted us. Then I contacted the FBI and got enough of the original email material to allow the FBI to investigate, you know, where this was really coming from. But it took that kind of sensitivity and attention on several people's part, you know, to get that spoofed email to the right place. But we've also seen emails that come in and, you know, the topics are entirely appropriate. They're referencing a conference, perhaps, that someone went to that was a legitimate conference and passing along material, you know, that allegedly was supposed to have been distributed at the conference and wasn't. So they go to great lengths. These are not Nigerian princes scams anymore, by any stretch. Plus, we also get the more garden variety, click here to get your facts. But those, I think, people are more wary of these days than the ones that are very, very specifically targeted for you.
Right, and a lot of them don't reach you anymore because of spam filters, whereas the more tailored ones still get right through.
Right. Now, one of the more sophisticated tools sets on the market today is what they call Sandbox and Detonate. So for every email coming into Brookings, probably about 80% actually get blocked immediately by spam filters. That's just how much spam is out there on the Internet. And that's not specific to Brookings. That's probably true across the board. But of the things then that get past our initial spam filter, every email goes through several different types of scans, and if it has an attachment, the attachment will actually be opened in what they call a virtual environment. Nobody's reading it, but the machine will open it and wait a certain period of time to see if something activates out of that attachment. And if it does, then the attachment and its associated email is blocked. Similarly, if there's a URL embedded, a link embedded within an email, it will also sandbox that. Click on the URL and wait to see what happens. It does it very fast, so email is still coming into Brookings, you know, very, very quickly. But I think in 1 month, this tool blocked something like 650 attachments coming in, and I don't know how many different people might have received that one email with an attachment, but there were at least 650 just in 1 month that came in.
So when a lot of users think of cybersecurity on their workstations, they are often thinking of sort of some passive virus scanning software, which is getting signatures from some central server and looking at traffic as it comes in and seeing if files match known signatures for malware and squelching stuff that does. You're describing something much more active than that. And my impression is that a huge amount of sort of enterprise-level cybersecurity is now much more based on sort of deep probing of network traffic and sort of patterns of traffic and behavior. How much of that does Brookings do? How much of that is contracted out to cybersecurity entities, and how much of that do we just not do?
Well, we do a lot more than we did 15, 18 months ago, both in tools that we've purchased and some outside services that we've contracted with to help us with all of the monitoring and tracking and analyzing that has to go on just because of the volume of traffic that goes through within and in and out of Brookings every day. In terms of how much do we do, it's sort of hard to quantify it. But I will say this, that because the advanced, more sophisticated type of malware is new and ever evolving, the companies that have sprung up in the last 5 to 8 years, they're very new, they're young, there aren't a lot of standards out there in the industry, you know, for how to do any of this. Some of the companies work with each other, some are more independent, and so it's a very immature market in a way. Even though these tools are very sophisticated, they're somewhat immature, and so sometimes the data that you get out of them can be very difficult to interpret.
What's an example of that?
Well, often when you see something suspicious, something that's been flagged as suspicious by one of these systems, the system itself can't tell you very much other than this is what happened, this is where it happened, this is what else was happening at the same time. And it takes a human to look at that and put it in the context of what would normally be going on whether it's a desktop or a server or a network device, and then do perhaps some more forensics to analyze whether it's actually malicious or not. Because you can get a lot of false positives in this business.
These new companies that have sprung up, and there's a whole bunch of them, and they all claim to have some piece of the magic bullet, or some set of magic bullets. What are they doing, broadly speaking, that's different from what companies have been doing for a long time?
Well, you mentioned a moment ago the scanning software that's signature-based. And that's still very important. And we still have signature-based detection. But the newer types of detection are not signature-based. They're actually, you know, looking for exactly what happens when you click on an attachment, as I mentioned before, in a sandbox environment. Because normally, if an attachment is not infected with malware, nothing's going to try to execute when you open that attachment. It's just a Word document or a PDF or something. So if an executable starts to run, that's an immediate flag, even before you know what the executable is, that it probably didn't belong there. But one of the newer companies that we're working with that was started in 2014, so just last year, is actually looking for patterns of behavior out on the internet and looking for types of traffic that are targeting Brookings. So, for example, we had a session with them just 3 or 4 weeks ago to say, what are you now seeing now that you have your appliances in our network? And they said, well, there's a legitimate ISP provider that is known, however, to be a vector for some state-sponsored actors. So not all the traffic coming over this ISP is bad, but some of it is. And we see Brookings usernames and passwords coming through this ISP on these dates and at these times, and we think you ought to check it out and see if those are legitimate or not. So we then actually contacted those users and said, it looks like you were trying to, these were all remote connections into Brookings. We see that you were connecting at such and such a time of day using such and such an ISP provider, and we just wanted to validate that that was really you. And then we have to reassure them that, as far as we know, there's nothing wrong with their account, and it is a legitimate ISP provider. It's just known to be a vector for, you know, bad guys on occasion.
And do you find that that sort of information is really useful, or is it just added noise and leads that you have to run down that overwhelmingly turn out to be false positives?
Well, we're getting better, and I think all the providers are getting better at deciphering whether something is a false positive or worth looking at. But we certainly, I would say, probably several times a week, have something that we go to check out one way or another, whether it's an alert that's gone off on a specific user's desktop or an FBI alert to go look for certain software strings that might be active on your network, et cetera.
So you have several times a week where you have events that are not, in your judgment, false positives.
Well, they certainly turn out to be worth looking into.
And yep. What's the denominator? How many events a week that then turn out to be a waste of somebody's time?
Probably perhaps an equal number if you average it out.
So about half the events are real.
Are worth
and
no,
it ends
pursuing
up being
and some are not.
2x where x is several.
Yes. I'd say on average that's probably true. Uh-huh. Sometimes there are campaigns. We'll get notified either by one of our peers or someone like the FBI or in one case Homeland Security about a particular campaign that seems to be going on, hitting a variety of types of enterprises. And in those cases, you know, we're just fine-tuning our filters to look for specific IP addresses or particular software strings. And maybe they show up and maybe they don't, but, you know, we respond to those sorts of notices.
So one of the things that we've heard a lot about is, you know, unpatched flaws in software, or sometimes 0 days in commercially available software. How many of these events that we're seeing are intrusions through vulnerabilities in commercial software, and how many of them involve more sort of mundane kind of human errors, people clicking on things they shouldn't click, or are those hard to disaggregate?
It's hard for me to disaggregate them. I'm sure there are security industry experts who would be tracking that at a better way than I can. But certainly trying to keep up with patching and notifications about zero-day vulnerabilities is part of what takes up that 20 to 25% of my time and more of some of my other people's time. I could get back to you with the statistics, but I want to say that we pulled the stats for 1 year, and I think there were something like probably over 860 security-related patches that came out either from Microsoft, Adobe, Java, you know, or some other relevant companies to us. So it's a significant, and some of them come out when it's a security-related patch, it can come out at any time, as opposed to Microsoft has what they call Patch Tuesday every month, and that's when their more routine things come out, but a security patch could come out at any time. And then we have to evaluate how vulnerable are we to it, and do we want to do something immediately or wait for our more routine cycle, yeah, to patch it.
And have you, I mean, I have argued, as you know, that companies that sort of knowingly don't patch in a timely fashion should bear some liability for damage that results as a consequence of those decisions. Do you find, as a general matter, that the companies are patching security-related matters in a prompt fashion, or is there still just a lot of sort of recklessly written code floating around?
Well, it varies a lot. I think, you know, some companies are certainly more attuned to it, particularly if to the security of their software, particularly if they view themselves or market themselves as being enterprise quality software, or if they've been in business for a long time. But there are certainly software providers who are infamous, or whose products are infamous, whether it's because they have an old code base that is just too sort of far-flung to be completely patched. I can't speak as to why some of these products have persisted. Well, they persist in the market because they become so ubiquitous that you almost can't live without them.
Try living without PDFs for a week.
Right, exactly. So that's why the software persists. As to why the vulnerabilities persist, or why there are so many vulnerabilities found in the same code base time after time, or version after version, you know, is hard for me to speak to. I've certainly worked for software developers long ago, and I know how difficult development and testing can be, but I've got to think that the industry has the techniques and tools now to do a better job than it's doing in many vectors.
So if you could wave your magic wand and change one thing about the average Brookings scholar and by extension, the average university professor, the average, right? I mean, the average person in a diffuse organization that does ideas for a living and that's supposed to engage with the rest of the world to make the project of securing the network infrastructure of said institution more manageable. What are the things that you'd wave your wand and do?
Um, Well, probably to educate themselves or take the education that we and others try to provide them to heart and more seriously. There's a lot of things that we can do within the Brookings enterprise to secure things, but I worry quite a bit about anyone dealing with their PC at home connecting to, any ISP provider, or taking, whether it's their personal laptop or a Brookings laptop, out to when they're traveling or to the coffee shop or wherever and being on public Wi-Fi networks. I think the literacy in general among users across the board, consumers across the board, about cybersecurity is very, very weak. And I'd love to see more public education done, for one. But within Brookings, certainly think before you click, could be a slogan we'd put up in the elevators. Because the social engineering is very good, because people are in a hurry, because people get, tons of email. And when you are so public and outward facing, if it looks like it's coming from somebody who might be interested in your work or a reporter or a friend of a colleague or something, then your natural inclination, obviously, is to respond or engage in whatever's in that correspondence.
Brookings scholars travel everywhere in the world, just about, including to the countries that are routinely attacking us. I suppose in that sense, it's not unlike the U.S. federal government. What do you tell a Brookings scholar who's about to get on a plane to China?
Well, actually, I'm about to author a newer set of recommendations after just conferring with some of our outside security consultants. Probably the most important thing you can do is take as few electronics and data with you as possible, and I realize that's very difficult. Here at Brookings, if people are traveling to certain countries, we advocate that they take what we call a loaner laptop, which is one that we can sanitize before it goes and put just the minimum amount of information that a scholar needs on it for whatever purpose they're traveling. Make sure that there are no cached passwords on it, because you have to assume that machine's going to get compromised once it's in country. And then wipe it when it gets back. And advocate that they change as many passwords as they can, but certainly their Brookings password. So we're very generous and supportive of people taking loaner equipment when they travel to certain countries.
How many other such countries are there? I mean, we're picking on China, but I assume it's not the only one.
No, I'd say there are probably three or four, that we recommend that people take loaner equipment and be very aggressive about password maintenance.
So you've described a remarkable range of activities that this institution has to go through, from, central IT to loaning people equipment for trips to sending people up to do even the most routine installations on people's workstations. How much does it all cost? What's the, if you sum up how much the Brookings Institution spends on cybersecurity, how would you think about, can you even estimate that? What's the tax that we're paying in cybersecurity?
Well, it's both staff time and out-of-pocket expenses for these software tools and monitoring services and outside, expertise and consultants. But clearly, it's costing us, hundreds of thousands of dollars more than we were spending, say, 5 years ago. Now, we're fortunate, and the good thing about being such a target is that there are software companies that give us their tools to use at no charge, because they know that they will see what the state-sponsored actors are doing, and that will help them improve their products that they then turn around and sell to the Fortune 500. So we're very fortunate in that way that we get those in-kind donations from certain companies. But nevertheless, there is some software and tools and services that we pay for, plus we've had to dedicate additional staff to security, and that adds up to several hundred thousand dollars a year.
And is the Brookings sort of leadership, board, management, one always hears about major companies that they don't appreciate and invest in the threat until there's some major disaster. My impression is that people here take it pretty seriously at a senior level, partly because we've had a number of knocks on the door from the FBI. Do you feel like when you say, hey, this needs to happen for cybersecurity reasons, that things happen?
Yes, I think the senior management here has been very supportive. They are, as you would expect them to be, concerned not only about the cost, but also the potential disruption to the work at Brookings. Security is often a trade-off with convenience, and we don't want to be so secure that no one can get any work done. So we have those discussions, and when we roll things out, like we're in the midst of a rollout of a change in security settings right now, we as an IT department go to pretty great lengths to make sure we've tested it, that we've educated people, that we're going to respond to any issues that come up, because some of these security tools can be fairly disruptive to people's work. But, you know, budget is always an issue. Now, our board has recently actually commissioned a security and privacy audit that we've just started. And I would think out of that will come some additional recommendations of what else we need to be doing, not only about the state-sponsored things, but the people who are interested in financial data and personally identifiable information use all the same techniques as the state-sponsored people. So by protecting one, you're doing what you need to do to protect everything, and yet some basic administrative procedures about who can have an account, who can keep an account once they've officially left Brookings, and for how long. You know, do we have adequate procedures in place to make sure that affiliates who are not on payroll, but as they come and go from the institution, are we always notified so that we can properly disable their accounts? You know, there are some things like that that we could probably do better on as well.
One last question, and I'll let you go. Do you have a sense of whether the same set of things, this wide-ranging stuff that you're describing, is going on at major universities, or is this a microcosm of what cybersecurity looks like in the nonprofit academic sector today, or is Brookings sort of ahead of the game here in the think tank community, more generally kind of ahead of the game here because we've been so overtly targeted that we've thought about things that universities are going to only start thinking about as, you know, intrusions start ever more frequently coming to light? But is this a set of... When you talk to your counterparts at universities, are they going through all the same stuff, or have they just not started thinking about it yet?
They've recently started thinking about it. In fact, there was a major state university system represented at the last FBI briefing I went to just a few weeks ago, and someone from one of the larger universities in the Washington area just contacted me a couple of months ago and wanted to talk about cybersecurity. I think they're... And I was in IT at a large research university for almost a decade, so I'm very familiar with how they operate and how generous they are and what latitude they give students and faculty and staff in terms of operating their own machines, having any type of machine they want, any type of device, all kinds of software, and being very, very, very open to the outside world. So it's going to be a really big challenge for them. I think they're concerned not only with the financial and personally identifiable information of their students, faculty, and staff, but also they have, in many research universities, issues about intellectual property that Brookings and think tanks don't have, because, as you say, most of what we do, we publish, and at Brookings we publish it largely for free, but at universities where they're doing truly applied research, that can turn into very, valuable inventions or patents or whatever. They have a whole different challenge there that I think is going to be very difficult for them. So it is something that research universities are now beginning to wake up to.
Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan. And as always, please spread the word and promote the Lawfare Podcast via your social networks, Twitter, Facebook, email, and in any other way you can. Thanks for listening.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.